And good evening and welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And tonight we will sound a bit different as we are socially distancing here at Red River Radio. Now, Cliff Shackelford is with me tonight in the studio, but Wally Derlis is down on the phone banks and we don't have any volunteers with us. So when you call in, please give Wally a break as he may have his hands full from time to time. We invite you to call in tonight with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He's also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks so much for joining us tonight as our expert.
Bill, looking forward to it.
And Cliff, at the end of last month, we had a conservation tip. Would you go ahead and recap that for us?
Yeah, we did a shout out for the 30th anniversary for a cooperative bird conservation effort known as Partners in Flight. Partners in Flight, it's not a club, it's not a nonprofit or a business. It's basically a way of thinking. And I cut my teeth early in my career working with a lot of great people that are part of Partners in Flight, including the national coordinator, Bob Ford. He wasn't national coordinator back in my early day. The late, great David Pashley was. But there's been several people with Partners in Flight throughout the country that I've worked with and have fond memories working with and mostly learning from people like Chuck Hunter and E.J. Williams and Dean Demarest and Carol Beardmore and so many other folks. So a big shout out to them. It's a way of thinking. It's one of the main themes is to keep common birds common. We talked about how nobody wants to see additions to a state or federal threatened and endangered species list. So Partners in Flight works collaboratively to reverse declines in birds and to keep common birds common, even our tiniest, often forgotten songbirds. So big shout out to Partners in Flight and all the good things they do throughout the country and the whole Western Hemisphere.
All right. Well, I'm trying to fix my microphone here. There's something kind of funky with it. But Cliff, each month we go into a bird profile, and what do you have for us this month?
Yeah, this month we're going to profile the Inca dove, and it has one of the easiest bird calls to memorize if you can visualize its mournful coos sounding like it's saying, no hope, no hope, no hope. So try visualizing those words as we listen to an Inca dove here. Not much variation. It's just no hope, no hope all the time. That's the Inca dove. The Inca dove does very well in urban areas or close to human habitation in rural settings. They'll come to seed feeders, especially those on the ground or if seed is spilled onto the ground. They often allow a close approach, which makes them quite vulnerable to predation by cats. This dove is smaller than a mourning dove and has a scaled appearance due to dark edging to its feathers. Plus, it has a long tail and a flash of rusty in the wings as seen during flight. Its original range, likely centered in Mexico, includes a significant expansion to both the north and south in the last century or more. To the north, it marched into Texas, being first recorded in Laredo in 1866. And it took roughly another quarter century to finally reach San Antonio in 1890. The first record for New Mexico was in 1924, and the first record for Louisiana was near Alexandria in 1935. It reached Oklahoma in 1955, and despite a few small populations north of there has really slowed down its northward expansion. Inca doves are sensitive to cold, and while roosting, they have an interesting and rare behavior of gathering in groups of, say, 5 to 12 doves, and they get in two or three rows stacked on top of one another, somewhat in the shape of a pyramid. It's called pyramid roosting, and it keeps them warm by sharing body heat. They look somewhat like sandbags stacked up two or three rows high. It's very, very few species of birds do this. Again, pyramid roosting. The bird's name does not suit it and likely was supposed to be called Aztec doves, since the Incas are South American, nowhere close to where this dove occurs. To see a photo of an Inca dove snapped by James Childress, please visit the bird calls page at redriverradio.org.
And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 with your calls. That's 800-552-8502. But first, we have a special guest with us tonight. And Cliff, I'm going to let you go ahead and do the intros.
Yeah, I'm going to introduce somebody who sent us a DVD maybe more than once showing what he's put together in his backyard using basically security cameras. And he pointed them on screech owls that he has in a nest box. And we've called Chuck Omi up. He's from El Lago, Texas. Chuck, are you on the line?
I'm here, Cliff.
Great. Thanks, Chuck. And so I understand you're a longtime listener. You were telling me earlier that you and your wife listen to the show a lot. Is that correct?
Oh, we do. In fact, the bird calls now being archived. We go back and listen to your old shows.
That's great. And so as a fan, Chuck took some of his recordings, video recordings, put them together, and sent us this latest one we've put online. Bill can tell us where it is here in a minute, but it's a 7.5-minute video. Bill, why don't you tell everybody where they can look at it while we're talking?
Yeah, you can go to our Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org. Just click that open and go right past. You'll scroll down, and you'll go right past our online profile species tonight, and you'll see the video there.
And so that video, Chuck, we want to hear about, you know, what inspired this. You know, it's obviously you're using equipment that's intended for probably other reasons, but you've got it very laser focused on some screech owls. So maybe tell us a little bit about the equipment and what your goal is and what you've uncovered and unveiled about your backyard screech owls.
Actually, you're the one that started me on it. A couple of years ago, you said, this is the time, this is late fall. You said, this is the time to build your bird houses, bird boxes, and put them up.
Mm-hmm.
I always liked owls because they're kind of secretive. They're at night, you don't see them. So anytime you see one, it is a treat. And so I put up an owl box. I didn't really think I was going to get anything, but all of a sudden I saw one. And ran out and got a video camera and started recording it. We just had a ball watching it, watching the babies eventually fledge, mom and pop running back and forth to the nest, feeding them. It was good 3 months.
That's great. And I should say that this is a small owl. This owl is only about the size of a 12-ounce soda can, so it's not an owl that you need to worry about if you have pets. The largest prey this guy's going to eat are going to be, you know, small mice, large arthropods like grasshoppers and katydids and crickets, and believe it or not, wood roaches. I've witnessed them eating that. But what's neat about your video is that it comes out in fairly good daylight and goes straight for what? It heads to your bird bath. So tell us about what you set up and how you determined to put one of the cameras. You're running four cameras, is that correct?
Correct.
And you've got one pointing at the bird bath, and that's where the screech owl goes, and it looks like the middle of the day. I don't remember if there's a time stamp on it. Maybe you would remember, but He's very busy looking around at the bird bath, and here comes a marauding blue jay. As most people know, blue jays are kind of the self-proclaimed police of the bird world, and they like to chase and harass predators like owls and squirrels and hawks and cats and so forth, and snakes. But you caught some really cool footage. So tell us a little bit about what your owl is doing in the footage.
The video starts out where the owl and its mama is in the owl box. It's just about dawn. And that's when she goes out, gets her exercise, goes to eat, takes a bath, drink, and flies to a bar I have in the backyard that's holding up a suet feeder.
Mm-hmm.
And she sits on that. I didn't know that at first because I put a woodpecker box in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was going into the owl box before the owls got there. And I said, okay, I'll quickly fill the woodpecker box and see if he'll go into it.
Yeah.
But I put a camera on that, and nothing happened. But the bar that is behind it, you can see it behind it, at night I'm seeing an owl. So now I'm understanding where the owl is going. So just by a little scouting around and finding out, I found 4 points with frequency, which would be naturally the owl box, the bar that holds up the suet feeder, and the bird bath with a drip on it.
Mm-hmm.
And also have another, on the side of the garage, have hummingbird feeders. And the owl will sit on the electrical panel, the electrical meter. It's funny. It just sits where it wants. So now I knew where to focus the cameras. And I set it up, and I look at it every morning. And I scroll through at 16 times normal speed, so a 12-hour night take me 45 minutes.
Uh-huh. And you're doing that every morning with a cup of coffee. Didn't you tell me that?
Yeah. So it's my morning routine.
That's cool. Instead of the newspaper, most of those have gone away. You're looking at the previous night's video of owls, so I love it. That's great. So Chuck, you told me once when we've been talking about this that you've learned something that I don't always think about, is the bird bath used more in the spring than in the hot summer. And can you tell us about what you uncovered that I think is pretty interesting?
What I noticed was in the spring, I get a lot of activity at the bird bath. And which I figure with the migration and everything coming through, that it could be normal. But what I'm also seeing is on my hummingbird feeders that after 2 days, a liquid gets real viscous. Mm-hmm. And after 3 days, it starts setting up like jello.
Mm-hmm.
I have to change it every other day. And later on in the summer, I noticed that the hummingbird feeders, after 3 days, are just like normal water, you know, normal water and sugar mixture.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to think that all the pollen in the air is the reason for the hummingbird feeders getting so viscous.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be also a reason that the birds so frequently.
Mm-hmm. Especially your screech owl, you noticed.
Yes.
Yeah, and that makes sense. You know, there's a lot of pollen in the air in March and April for those of us here in the south, southeast, especially with pines around and all the other trees. So I thought that was a really cool observation. And, I mean, this is where technology is really opening our eyes to a whole different world out there. And we've mentioned that before about game cameras taking stills, but this is, I think, so much better. You're taking videos that you can see, you know, minutes and minutes and hours of activity. So kudos to you, Chuck, for doing what you're doing. And it's great that you've got such a cool hobby like that, like this, and sharing this with us. So I hope listeners that are intrigued will go to the website that Bill mentioned and look at your video, Chuck. And so last question, tell us a little bit about the equipment.
As you said before, the cameras are security cameras, and they have a zoom lens on them, 3-to-1, and at night they switch over to infrared, and that's where I get real fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and the images are crisp. I really am impressed how good the images are, day or night.
Yeah, they're pretty good cameras, but you get these little red dots in front of the camera, and that lights up the whole backyard, and it's hard to believe that little light, and this camera can detect that. The cameras are zoom, and it switches over to infrared at night.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing is, I watch it, and I see more animals in my backyard that I never thought would be there.
Oh, neat.
Everything from armadillos, rats, mice, possums, raccoons. We have more neighborhood cats than I ever imagined.
Oh, wow.
It's interesting. I pretty much only watch it for the night videos now.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. So, Chuck, thank you for letting us call you and hear more about what you're doing and the details about it. And thanks so much, Chuck. We appreciate it.
Anytime. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, sir.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now. Our lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Go ahead and give us a call. We have phone lines open right now. And, Cliff, we have a number of photos that have been sent in, as well as some audio. Let's go through those right now while we're waiting for phone calls to come in.
The one at the top here is a mirror of a vehicle, and our friend Ann Tyndale sent that in, and she was curious what this bird was that was bobbing and sitting on her rearview mirror of the outside of her truck, looking at itself in the mirror. And I have never seen an American pipit do this. So this is an American pipit, and she noticed it was bobbing. And there are not many birds that do that, kind of like not a tail wagging, but just kind of a pumping up and down. There are only a handful of birds that even do that. Water thrushes are a good example. And this bird looks superficially like a water thrush, but it's not. It's certainly a water thrush. American pipit that is attacking its reflection in the mirror, which this is at Brazos Bend State Park in Houston, which is the wintering ground for this bird. So I just think this is really cool that she sent this, because I've never heard of a pipit doing this on the wintering grounds, attacking its own reflection, thinking it's a intruder. And kudos to Ann for sending that. And then scrolling down, Bill, we've got what is that? Those are some pelicans. That who sent that in? I can't read it.
No, well, that was Marcy Woodward.
Yep, Marcy sent some pelicans that she has. It's really nice. And keep going down. There's a summer tanager, a pretty fuzzy summer tanager that I think this person called, is that right? And described a bird. I said,
yes.
I have no idea. I think I said Eastern Phoebe. And then what's funny is before the show was over, my wife texted me. She listens. And she said, it was probably a female summer tanager. Well, Dakota sent a photograph. This is just one of a couple she sent that is a fuzzy photo of a female summer tanager. So awesome job to everybody on that one. Keep scrolling. And then the last picture is by Steve Gunter, and it's a great blue heron up in a field. And that's something you'll see in the wintertime, especially when waters start to freeze over. Or the water's edge of a pond freezes over and the great blue heron can't do what it normally does by feeding in the shallows. It'll shift to upland environments and go after rodents. And there have been some super cold winters where I've been out and all the waters, the smaller bodies of water have been frozen over, and the great blue herons have all moved in the fields, and they're feeding on rats and other rodents up in pocket gophers and whatever they can get. I like to think of it as a good change of flavor because these guys are eating stuff in wetlands, fish, crawfish, things like that. So maybe something furry is a good change of flavor for it.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have all lines open right now. You'll get right in. And in the meantime, we have our annual Christmas bird count coming up. Cliff, could you talk to some folks about that?
We really like to promote the Christmas bird count. This is a little bit different year with the pandemic because it is a social event, but you can do it socially distancing yourself or as a couple or family, you can do that. So this was initiated in the year 1900 by Dr. Frank Chapman and of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City and his many friends and volunteers. It came about because he was looking for something to replace the 1800s so-called side hunt, which involved winters having the largest pile of dead critters, mostly birds and mammals. And that was in the late 1800s that he decided, hey, we need something, we need an alternative that's more sustainable. So he came up with this idea of tallying birds instead of collecting them, and for no reason. The side hunts, you weren't doing it for food, you were just trying to do it for volume to compete against neighbors and friends and family. So it's actually the longest running citizen science project in the world. The National Audubon Society is the organization that runs it. It's their flagship event. In 2012, Audubon reported that they had 60,000 observers in 20 countries, counting in 2,200 different circles, and they tabbed over 64 million birds of about 2,400 species all over the world where there's Christmas counts. The official count period runs from December 14th to January 5th. On the website, Bill has put up some of the areas' Christmas counts and who the compiler is and how to get a hold of them by email and what date they're planning to go out and do their counts. And if you've never done one, this might be the year to maybe volunteer as a feeder watcher if your house or your property is inside the circle. So I should mention that it's a fixed 15-mile diameter circle where these annual counts occur over time. And so if you're in that circle, they're always looking for volunteers. The people that are well seasoned and do this know how to cover their area and do it responsibly. I'm going to, for example, I do my count with a couple of friends, and we're going to take a couple vehicles, we're going to wear masks, we're going to do all the correct things, and we're going to be outside looking at birds. It's just a great way to get involved. It's a 24-hour count. The local one in Nacogdoches is compiled by David and Mimi Wolf. It's going to be held Sunday, December 20th, so I'll be taking part of that. And it's just a lot of fun. And after decades of doing a Christmas count, because that circle hasn't moved, You can look at valuable trend data. You can see things like in the winter of 2018-19, that was a great year for purple finches in Texas. That's a bird that goes through these cyclical periods of being here or being absent from here. So they're a lot of fun. There are over 110 Christmas counts in my state of Texas. Here in Louisiana, there are about 26 Christmas counts. Up in Arkansas, you've got about 30 different Christmas counts, and in Mississippi you've got about 20 Christmas counts. So to find a Christmas count, you can do a Google search using those words. It'll take you to the National Audubon website. You can scroll down and look for, quote, join the CBC or Christmas bird count. Click there, then scroll down and look for words in blue font that says, quote, a map view of the circles. And then you can see the different CBC maps and click on the circle that interests you, and it'll include the compiler's name and email. So there are some counts that aren't going to happen this year because of the pandemic, So there are fewer on our list this year than the previous several years that we've promoted the local CBCs. But this is not just a local event. This is national. So wherever you're listening in the U.S., you're going to have a count near you. And they're actually global. There are many different countries that have Christmas counts. So they're a lot of fun.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have Karen online from Tyler, Texas. Karen, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
I wanted to, I saw a bird that I had not seen before, kind of a beginning birder. So I may have seen it before and not been paying attention. But the best I could tell... when I went and looked in the Merlin app and then also in a bird book that I have, it seemed like it was the closest to the dark-eyed junco, or maybe it didn't really quite look like this eastern phoebe in the picture, but that was it was similar. So I hadn't seen them before at the bird feeder, and then I saw several of them. And then I saw them in an open lot. Also today I saw one and could see it a little better. It seemed to have black or dark gray all down its back and a white belly. And I'd say it seemed like to me at the distance I was, it was about the length of maybe my hand.
Okay. Those two birds are in the listening area. They're in most backyards and the lots, like you mentioned, but they act quite different. The dark-eyed junco is a sparrow relative, so he's going to be on the ground a lot. He's going to do a little hen scratching in the leaf litter. He's going to come up to the feeder to look for seeds. He's going to be in the groups, like you mentioned. And a really good distinction is when it flies, it flashes some white in the tail that you don't see very well when the bird is relaxed or perched. But when it flies, it kind of flicks its tail, and you'll see a flash of white, snow white. So that's the junco. The phoebe, typically, it's a flycatcher. It's in the family flycatcher. So it sits up on a perch, typically, sallying out, catching aerial insects. So just the behavior can really help if you've narrowed it down those two. And I'm guessing from when you said you saw several, that would eliminate the phoebe. You can see one or two together, but I've never seen three or four together. So if you saw a group, I would say it's probably the junco.
Yeah, they were three or four, and they were on the side on the porch, like under the bird feeder, seeming to get the seeds there. That had fallen out.
And that's a winter bird here, and it's got a colloquial name of snowbird. Because they leave that snow country and come winter with us where it's mild. So you'll hear some people called snowbirds. People from New York like to go to Florida, and people in Texas and Louisiana that like the winter here that come from the Midwest or the Great Lakes. They leave Michigan, for example, and come to the coast of Louisiana or Texas. Those are snowbirds, too. So it's a great little nickname for both people, certain people, and a certain bird, and this is the snowbird, the dark-eyed junco.
Cool. One of the pictures on the Merlin Bird app called it a slate-colored.
Yeah, and there's different races, and so that's probably the one you saw as a slate-colored race of the dark-eyed junco.
Yeah, that was a picture. That picture looked the most like what I saw when I flipped through, because it had about six or seven pictures. So when I saw that one, I think that's what I saw. So, thank you. I just wanted to hear a little more about them. So.
Great. Thank you, Karen.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have all lines open right now, so you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. In the meantime, Dan Hammack had also sent in some audio for us to listen to.
Let's listen.
So let's give a listen to this. It's a little bit low, but if you listen to it in the background, you can hear the bird he's talking about. And he thought it was a bobwhite. That's it.
Yeah, and that is, it's a two-note call. I can see why I think it's a bobwhite, but that is the bell call of the blue jay. And blue jays make all kinds of different strange calls. They can sound like a squeaky gate. And so forth. But this is the bell call of the blue jay. And it's that was a pretty good recording and very neat to send in. So,
and we bring that up. One of the questions that we have a lot is where have the bobwhites gone to in our area?
Yep. And we talk about that more than anything, I bet. And so I don't want to go on and on about it, but we've really changed our grasslands. We've eliminated native grasses. We've replaced them with old world species that, you know, when you're driving around the country, you might see all these pastures and say, what's he talking about? There's so many grasslands and pastures out here. It's the wrong kind of grassland. It's usually a monoculture of carpet grass versus native grasses grow in clumps that with disturbance like fire and grazing keeps some bare ground for quail to run around. They'd rather run on the ground with a little cover like those native grasses to hide them because they know they taste good to predators. But they can't do that on top of a coastal Bermuda pasture because, again, it's a carpet grass and there's nowhere to hide. And if that Bermuda grass is grazed to less than ankle high, there's nowhere to hide. And so bobwhite just don't occur there. So driving around, look at the difference between a non-native pasture and native pasture. It's a huge difference, and you'll see very few native pastures compared to the non-natives.
So I guess, the operative question is if we replaced and went back to native grasses in a lot of these areas, would we see a return of these, or have we just overdeveloped and cut down too many of these large pasture areas?
That's a good question. I think if you have a source population, if you've got some nearby quail, and we spent time and money to enlarge that real estate that favors them, yes, you could see them come back. But if you did that on a scale of normal land ownership, which in East Texas is about 110 acres, I think is the last figure I've seen that's average land ownership, it won't work. Bobwhite require large tracts of real estate. We're talking 10,000 acres minimum. Some experts say that's for self-sustaining. Some experts use numbers that are in the 200,000 acre figure for, you know, genetically sound, self-sustaining populations. So quail don't spring back on little chunks. Now, I know that there's going to be people that are going to call and say, well, I've seen a quail on my property. I only own 65 acres. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about to have quail all the time and they're self-sustaining. You've got to have, you and your neighbors have got to have a lot of real estate of correct habitat that is to the liking of bobwhite. And that's an endangered species right there.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world is welcome. And yes.
And let me correct myself. So when I said that's an endangered species, I'm not talking about the quail. I'm talking about the properties that can that I mentioned that could be used to bring the quail back. So that community, those owners, those landowners with the right stuff, that's the endangered species. I'm not talking about the quails, not endangered.
Okay. But the bobwhite have definitely disappeared because there's just not enough.
Yep.
But they're still in other places in this country,
correct? The last two strongholds are in Texas, the Rolling Red Plains or Red Rolling Plains up in the Wichita Falls area, and then in South Texas, Kingsville, and south and west of there are some strongholds there, but drought is a huge problem. And if we get if we have an extended drought in any of those areas for 8 or 10 years, it's going to be super detrimental.
And we did have a caller who didn't want to go on the phone or go online with you, but they said dinosaurs. Matt from Shreveport just wanted to pass on that he saw a roadrunner running through a parking lot in the Southern Hills area of Shreveport, and said it sure can run pretty fast.
Cool. Yeah, I saw Roadrunner on Sunday I was in Rusk County driving to Cherokee County, and I saw one. I mentioned that on the show. I always make note of where I see them in East Texas. That's a bird that historically wasn't here. It's moved eastward because we've opened up the forest and created openings for a bird that doesn't like forest. It likes forest edge, but if you look at where they are, they're usually on the road right-of-ways, in fields and pastures, and yeah, they'll go into the thickets and the woods to get cover when they've been seen for protection, but it's a bird of open country.
So any coyotes chasing them out there?
Meep, meep.
Wily coyote.
Yeah.
Give us a call at 800-552-8502 if you have a question for Cliff tonight. This is Bird Calls. And we have Billy from Jasper online with Cliff. Billy, go ahead. What's your question?
Hello, Cliff. Cliff, I've met you out at Danby before several times. My question is this. I've got a brother-in-law who is an expert deer hunter. Okay, but he doesn't know birds.
Okay.
And a lady earlier called in about Eastern Phoebes versus Juncos.
Mm-hmm.
I saw an Eastern Phoebe yesterday in my backyard for a little short while, and I've got a whole bunch of Juncos on my feed.
Cool.
But he tells me that this, as he describes it, and this is an anecdotal report, mm-hmm. and I wanted to see if you had ever heard this kind of report before, that he saw a silvery, grayish-black bird that was hovering around deer. He was watching the deer. He's a big deer hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pecking ticks and fleas off the deer like an oxpecker would in mm-hmm. Africa.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that story?
Only in dreams. Yeah,
okay.
Only in dreams. So he did not witness that. He fell asleep in the deer blind, and he dreamt it.
Okay.
It's,
you think that Phoebe does not... I have had two Phoebes. I have a swimming pool. I've had two Phoebes. One year we drained the pool during the winter, and bugs would get in the pool, and then they would drown on the bottom or stick on the walls.
Yeah.
And those two Phoebes would hover on beside the wall and peck those bugs off the wall of my pool.
I'm thinking more of the comment that you said. He said it was a silvery bird, right?
Right.
And so it got me thinking about a northern harrier that is, the males are silvery, and they do hover over grasslands, but they are looking for hispid cotton rats and other.
Yeah, they're huge.
And they're large.
Baby.
So, if you're telling me that he saw something pecking flies off a deer, I mean, I don't.
Ticks off
no,
deer.
Definitely not. No.
He's seen that twice, he said.
I don't know what he's seen. I mean,
I don't know what he's seen either.
We would see it with livestock, and I've driven by and stared at a lot of cows and been to places where cows were on the property. I've never seen that. So, like an oxpecker, he mentioned, I'd say.
No, I mentioned it. I've
okay,
seen
you mentioned
it.
Yeah, but still.
There are two species of oxpecker.
Yeah. He fell asleep. He dreamt
okay.
it. He dreamt
I'll,
it.
I'll let him know. Thanks,
yeah.
Cliff.
All right.
Hey,
thanks, Billy.
I really enjoy listening to y'all.
Oh,
show.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Yep. Bye-bye.
Sounds like a fun dream, though. You know.
It is, yeah. And it would be good for any creature that has ticks all over it. I would love to have this bird he mentioned, which is an oxpecker, and it's in Africa. There are two species, at least two, red-billed, yellow-billed maybe, and they glean ectoparasites off of large mammals. You'll see them on shows of Africa. They're on the hippo, they're on the giraffe, etc. They would be good to have, but we just don't have that here. I don't know what that fella saw, but I'd say take video. And I know that's a hard homework assignment for a small bird way out far on a deer, but unless you have some kind of evidence, some kind of proof, this is a hard one to swallow.
Yeah, you know, I could have used that bird last time I went camping. So
yeah,
always right under the kneecap, you know. I mean, right in the back there. So you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. John from Longview is up next. John, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
That's 800.
John?
5-5-8-5-0-2.
Turn down your radio,
John. Okay, I think I got the wrong one. John, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Okay, there we go.
Okay, I have a comment first that used to feed backyard feeders for years and would see the Inca doves, and I had friends that would call it Mexican doves.
Uh-huh.
Lived out of town for several years and have retired and moved back, and we're just going to get started again. But anyway, one of the comments was I used to throw a half a cup of seed out on the back driveway just mm-hmm. for the doves, and I'd go out at first light and you'd see doves lined up on the tree limbs, and I, as well as the evil squirrels waiting for me to throw it out.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's neat. And that's true that the dove just would prefer the seat on the ground. They don't want to be front and center up on that feeder. They will, don't get me wrong, but you want to see a lot of dove put the seat on the ground, like you mentioned. So that's cool, John.
Well, what my question concerns is, having moved back here this spring and summer, is we have quite a few of mature oak trees, and they had almost no bloom this year, and we made no acorns at all. And in the past, only birds I really noticed eating on the acorns in the yard would be the blue jays. And I know there are some wild, you know, turkeys and whatnot. Are there other songbirds that feed on the acorns as a main staple? And is there something I can feed as an alternate, because there are not going to be any this year?
Yeah, some of our oaks are cyclical or even every other year. So it's not unusual for us to go acorn-free some years. So it depends on the species. Some are annual, depends on the species of oak. So there are years, and then, you know, it could be drought-related. So it's not unusual for us to go without acorns. And there's nobody that has to have acorns. You know, even the squirrels that love them, they can switch to other things. You know, they'll even eat leaf buds if they have to, or lick sap after a sapsucker has worked on a tree. So, no, I wouldn't worry about putting stuff out for them. I think doing just what you're doing, throwing the sounds like maybe hen scratch or sunflower seeds, whatever you were saying you threw out for the dove, that's the best thing to do. But I mean, you know, you don't buy commercially available bags of any mast except for maybe pecan, and man, that stuff's so expensive. I'm barely gonna afford it, a big bag for myself. I'm not gonna feed it to all the hogs and the things that I don't want eating it out there. But if you want to get some cracked pecans, you know, those are cheaper. The damaged, or not damaged, but the imperfects, that's something you could put out. There are a lot of birds that would love that, where they're still in the shell, but it's cracked open, and they can dig that the meat out of the shell. That's something to do. But yeah, feral hogs are big competitor for a lot of our native wildlife. You know, those acorns in the bottoms were intended. You mentioned one of them. Wild turkey, white-tailed deer, a lot of birds, not just the blue jay, but, you know, red-headed woodpeckers are in the bottoms looking for acorns. You'll see common grackles coming through in the mid to late winter, and they're looking for smaller, like water oak, Quercus nigra, acorns, and they'll gobble those up. So there are a lot of birds that need them, but nobody's totally dependent on it. That's a good thing, because we might not have a good year of acorns.
So if I just go with some regular feeders and maybe some soot feeders, that would help the woodpeckers I would guess.
Oh yeah, so that would help too.
That was my main concern.
Yeah, cool. Well, you're doing the right thing, John. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open except for this one, and we do have David from East Texas near Jasper online. David, what's your question tonight? Oh, you got to turn your radio down, David.
My question is, I build these little cypress birdhouses, like 6x6x10, and just for the bluebirds and stuff. And I put several out around my garden, and I'm getting chickadees and other variety of birds. And then I got just some just around the yard, you know, just put them on a fence post, but it don't seem to attract them. I was just wondering if there's certain areas I need to put them, or if I'm what I'm doing wrong.
Yeah, I don't think you're doing anything wrong if you've got some use, because you got to think about, wait, hold on a minute. You got the TV in the background?
Yes,
let's turn all that off.
Yeah, we get an echo otherwise, because there's an 8-second delay.
Yeah, I can't hear you too well. Okay, that's better. So, David, I think you're doing all right when you said you had some occupancy, because what you have to realize is you won't get, you know, 15 pair of chickadee, titmouse, or bluebird in one average yard, because all those species are very territorial. So you're only going to get the one pair that of each of those in a given yard. But I'd say try some other varieties, some bigger houses, and get some of those higher up. Maybe look for blueprints online for a flicker box that can be used by red-bellied woodpecker for mid-sized woodpeckers. That's a good one. And then the call earlier with Chuck Omi, a screech owl box, and get that one up higher. And I'm talking, 15 or 20 feet, but not on a fence post. So you want to try different shapes and sizes to get a different variety of birds. But I think from what I've heard, you're tapped out on all those birds that are in that range of titmouse, chickadee, nuthatch, bluebird. So you've done a good job. I'd say just try different makes and models, and you'll be good.
I was just wondering, because I put them out around my garden, and I got one on each end of the garden. And they build in them, raise their youngs, and then I open the door and clean it out. And it seems like, it ain't long, another one is coming. And I do have one up about 10 foot, but I've never had none to build in it.
Yeah, and some of these birds are particular. It could be that it's pointing the wrong way, or there's a limb that's too close that it just is nervous about. Because that limb might be where a predator could sit too close. So, I think what you've done is really good. You've kind of what I'd call saturate the site with a lot of choices, and that's how you get you get occupancy better because of probability that you're gonna. More boxes mean more chances. So you've done a good job. But, I wouldn't worry about the ones that aren't being used. That you never know if something else will come in and use it. And then when you've cleaned it out, that the next pair could be actually the same pair, because a lot of our birds will have second and even sometimes third clutch in a given breeding season. So it's pretty neat. Yeah. Okay, David. Well, thank you for the call, sir.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call. We have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And any question regarding our avian world is welcome. And in the meantime, other than Bob White's, what were some of the other birds that we have seen? And quail have diminished, but I know there are other birds because of loss of habitat in this area. Fill folks in on some of those birds that have gone missing from our area.
Yeah, so in this listening area, so historically, and I don't think anybody is old enough to have seen passenger pigeon, ivory-billed woodpecker, Carolina parakeet. There were even in the listening area up near Marshall, Texas, was one of the last reports of the interior subspecies of the greater prairie chicken. So, but these are all birds that are probably forever gone. Now we still have some Atwater's variety of the greater prairie chicken down near the coast, but it's just hanging on by a thread. And Hurricane Harvey sure didn't help. In 2017, I think, is when it hit. We're missing a lot of birds, but in retrospect, we've got some birds that have, even in my lifetime, colonized the area. And is it good or bad? I don't know. But, house finch has moved in. Great-tailed grackle has moved in. Eurasian collared dove has moved in.
English or European starling.
The starling certainly has moved in prior to my lifetime. There's a lot of birds that moved in before I came around. Cattle egret, the first record in Texas was in the mid-50s. So, there's a changing of the avifauna. But it's sad that, the ones that are gone are just really cool. I mean, how cool would it have been to see, what was written about pasture pigeons in the 1800s, of so many, the sky was darkened, and the flocks would take, hours to pass by. And then the roosts, people would write about roosts that just, the birds would roost in small little areas, and the piles of poop would would kill the vegetation underneath. There would be so many pasture pigeons. So I would have loved to see an ivory-billed woodpecker, no question.
I bet you had a green area the next year, though.
Yeah.
After all that
That's
decays.
Right. Yeah.
All right, and we have another caller online. Leon from Bossier City is on with Cliff. Leon, what's your question tonight?
I talked to you last time you were on, Cliff.
Okay.
About the geese, and I've yet to hear those darn geese come down. Have you heard any of them yet?
No, I still haven't. Not where I live. I did go since we talked. I've been in Jefferson County, Texas. I was not far from Port Arthur, Texas. I was west of and had lots of geese down there. Mostly snow geese and a few greater white-fronted geese. No Canadas, no cacklings, but two species of geese. And you know, those probably either flew over East Texas when I was asleep and when you were asleep, or they skirted around our area, but they're already on the wintering grounds on the coastal prairies. And so south of you, if you're in Bossier, you have what's called the Cajun Prairie down on the coast, which is, you know, roughly south of Lake Charles and including Lake Charles and Lafayette and south of, and you got a lot of geese in that country as well. So I think, Leon, it might be time for a field trip. If you want to see geese, you're going to have to probably catch up to them because their passage might be done over Bossier. But you can go down, do a day trip into the Cajun Prairie and look for some. And while you're down there, get some good Cajun cooking because, man, Lafayette, Lake Charles, whoo, good eating down there.
Amen.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the call, Leon, and good luck with the geese.
Okay, Masha. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We still have a little time left, but you got to get in right away. And, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to continue some more stuff I had about the Christmas bird counts. There are some birds that are, at least in Texas, that are typically found on every count. And it's kind of neat to see species that can really blanket the state. And three come to mind. The American kestrel, the red-tailed hawk, and the mourning dove are three that are found on just about every count in Texas. And that's about 110 of those counts. Then the next tier are species that are almost statewide and almost blanket Texas. They're widespread. And those are things like northern cardinal, ruby-crowned kinglet, northern mockingbird, great blue heron, European starling, killdeer, savannah sparrow, house sparrow, belted kingfisher, and eastern phoebe. These are birds that are showy often and good numbers and can be found on a lot of Christmas counts in Texas and in Louisiana, and in Arkansas and in Mississippi. A lot of these birds we all share. Even though we have different borders, the birds don't respect those political boundaries. So get out and do a Christmas count. They're a lot of fun. And if it's a weird year for you, and I don't blame you because of COVID, then maybe think about it, research a little bit more, and hopefully things will get back to normal for the next Christmas count season, and you can enjoy it, hopefully COVID-free.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have one more caller to get in, Ann from Minden. Ann, you are on with Cliff. What's your question? Hello, Ann.
I've called in a little bit late, but my question is this. Do you recommend an app for the phone when we hear a bird sound that's good at kind of identifying them? I've tried one, and it didn't do very good. Are you familiar with any?
Yeah, we've talked about one, what's it called, Song Sleuth, I think. You got to pay for it. Is that the one you used?
No, it was a free one called BirdNet.
Oh, yeah.
One of the universities.
I don't think they're there yet. But I strongly recommend, and one of the callers today mentioned Merlin. It's a bird app. It's basically like a field guide on your app, but it can't do what you're saying. You can't record something and play it to, you know, the app hears it and says it's maybe this or that. But it'll you can, it'll question you about what the bird is doing and what it looks like and what the dominant color is and behavior, and it can really help narrow it down.
Because it
knows your, you'll tell it where you are, so it knows your geography and what birds are in that area. So it won't tell you exactly what it is, but it'll take a full bird book full of 900 species and trim it down to, hey, it might be one of these six species.
Okay.
And then you'll look at those six species and go, oh, there it is. It's the fourth one right here.
Okay, so, that's Merlin?
Merlin, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And I apologize if this was a duplicate question.
No, it's not. And these are topics I don't mind rehashing because we get new listeners all the time. So, no, we didn't talk about that tonight.
Thank you so much.
Very good. Thank you, Ann.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. And it's that time of the show again for our conservation tip for this week. Cliff, what do you have for us?
Yeah. Tonight we're going to talk about roadways and good vehicle use and maintenance. So we all know that a safe driver is the best kind of driver, but did we all know that maintaining our vehicles is not only good for our pocketbook, but good for wildlife? Removing excess weight from our vehicles and maintaining proper air pressure in our tires means we'll get better gas mileage and reduce fuel emissions, which saves you money and is better on the environment. While driving, please be cautious when you see wildlife near the side of the road. This includes hawks, vultures, or even eagles feasting on roadkill. Owls and other raptors often sit on a low perch on one side of the road, yet see a tasty rodent on the other side of the road, making them fly low in pursuit, especially in rights of way with a lush layer of tall or medium height grasses and weeds. Roadsides need to be unattractive to wildlife, otherwise they could lure critters in harm's way. Deer and feral hogs are two to really watch out for while you're driving. Hitting one means possible injury to yourself and more roadkill that then attracts more scavenging birds to the dangers of the road's edge. So keep your vehicle in its best shape possible and slow down for wildlife. It's not only best for the critters, it's best for you. Do it for the birds.
All right. Cliff, once again, I want to thank you for joining us and being our resident expert here on Bird Calls.
Great. Thank you, Bill, for all you do.
You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program tonight. Tonight's program was made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. The producers for this show are myself, Bill Beckett, and Cliff Shackelford, and our phone bank assistant was Wally Derleth. We'd like to thank Les Stewart, who circulated announcements on social media about upcoming episodes of Bird Calls. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. The sound files for tonight's profile species were from xenocanto.org and were recorded by Doug Knapp. This month's bird photo on the Bird Calls page was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website as soon as we can get it up there. Tonight, just go to redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird that you would like to identify, you can send it to my email address. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. wbeckett@lsus.edu. Be sure to join us for the next installment of Bird Calls on Tuesday, January 12th. And this is Red River Radio. Thanks for listening tonight.